My name is William Rivers Pitt. I am the managing editor and lead writer for truthout.org. I'm the author of three books. First one, War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, which was a New York Times and international bestseller that got translated into about 12 languages. Second book that is out right now is called The Greatest Sedition is Silence. And I have a third book coming out very shortly called Our Flag 2, The Paradox of Patriotism. And I was a high school teacher for many years of English literature, journalism, writing, grammar, and history. I was a dean. I'm currently an expert for the Institute for Public Accuracy.
And you will be actually coming to Seattle as part of your book promotion for The Greatest Sedition is Silence here on the 21st. So
that is correct. I'll be coming to Seattle, and I apparently am going to be speaking at the big greeting that everyone is cobbling together for George when he comes to town.
Yeah, I heard about that. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah.
We'll get back to that. Let me start out and ask you, I understand you've just recently been to the National Veterans for Peace Conference. Can you tell us about that?
I was given the just absolutely stunning honor of being invited to deliver the keynote address for the Veterans for Peace National Convention out in San Francisco. That lasted from Thursday through Sunday. And I have to tell you, I am still now, I've been home for a day, at an absolute loss to describe how remarkable and powerful and excellent these people are. I mean, do you want to talk about moral authority? They've got it falling out of their ears. This organization is dedicated to changing the manner in which the militarization of the United States exists as it has existed for so very long. I mean, the fact that we've been on a permanent war footing since World War II, in a situation where that war footing, coupled with the trillions of dollars that are dumped into an ever-growing Defense Department and War Department, means, as far as they are concerned, is that we're dealing with a situation where this Department of Defense and War Department that we have, we have to fight wars in order to justify the existence of this thing. So developing any sort of ability to deal with the world in any kind of a peaceful way becomes a veritable impossibility with a Defense Department as expensive and huge as this is, because it requires a war to justify why it's there in the first place. And these guys, that were you talking about Vietnam vets, Korean War vets, World War II vets, Gulf War vets, there to spend several days together talking about peaceful ways to deal with this, talking about depleted uranium, talking about their experiences, Korea, Vietnam, World War II. They did workshops. Dennis Kucinich came out to speak to them. A number of vets from a number of wars spoke. And all in all, it was just a remarkable experience, culminating on Sunday with a bus trip out with a couple of thousand people to the Livermore Labs nuclear processing facility out there in Livermore, California, where about 1,500, 2,000 people got together to commemorate the dropping of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs on the 58th anniversary of those things happening, throwing a large protest there with a lot of speakers, and at the end of it, they all marched down to the laboratory itself, linked hands, and wrapped themselves all the way around the perimeter fence of the laboratory.
So that being a very appropriate place to go, probably the birthplace of the real weapons of mass destruction.
Just about every kind of nuclear weapon technology that we have in America is coming out of Livermore Labs. And given the fact that the Bush administration is throwing over these nuclear treaties and is furthermore talking about developing things like mini-nukes for use on the battlefield, makes the day that we spent out there at Livermore profoundly appropriate, over and above marking the anniversary of the dropping of those two bombs.
Last time we talked to you, it was back in March, it was the 21st of March, and it was literally the day that the U.S. had begun its shock and awe bombing in Iraq. Some things have changed since then, and one of those is the rhetoric for why we were bombing them. I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
Well, they've changed their rhetoric because their original rhetoric has proven out in some cases, in many cases, to have been bald-faced lies, and the rest of their rhetoric, while not having been proven to be a lie yet, is proving difficult to locate because, gosh almighty, there don't seem to be any weapons in Iraq. So the rhetoric that they've shifted to is something about bringing our values over there, which is about as close to the concept of, I mean, I'm a Catholic, so I know all about crusades. and it smells very much like a crusade here when we talk about bringing our values over there. One of the interesting things about this is that the folks who are running this organization are this cabal of neoconservative types who have been planning this for years and years and years. One of the intellectual godfathers of this group is a gentleman named Norman Podhoretz, who described the process of going to war in Iraq many, many months ago as a process that will bring about, and this is a quote, the reformation and modernization of Islam. The justifications that were given regarding the weapons of mass destruction, the uranium from Niger, the Al-Qaeda connections, were a useful rhetorical tool back when the administration felt like it needed to terrify the American people into an unnecessary war. But these reasons that are coming out now are very much closer to the original reasoning behind this war in the first place. And it's about bringing our values over there, eliciting regime changes in that country, in all those countries within the Middle East, to westernize the region.
Well, and when they say values, I think a lot of Americans might fall back and think of the good values that this country once upon a time stood for. But what are the real values you think they're actually bringing?
Well, I've always said that it's a rather terrible thing to have happened to the United States of America to allow these particular individuals to use words like freedom and justice and democracy and patriotism, because those words pretty much become lies when those good words become lies when they pass these people's lips. They're not interested in any of that. They're not interested in freedom. They're not interested in democracy. They will pervert patriotism for their own ends. They are in this to make a buck. At the end of the day, a lot of this is about financial gain, about controlling a resource, about controlling a region, and about knocking down an ideology that a lot of them genuinely think came straight from the devil. A lot of these people are real, committed evangelical Baptist types who look at Islam and the struggle that the Western world is having with Islam as an apocalyptic battle between good and evil. And when you have people like that with the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, nuclear weapons at their disposal, you wind up traveling down some fairly frightening roads.
And it seems that a lot of the people who are leading the charge in this vein are cashing in literally on what's happening currently in Iraq.
Oh, you wouldn't believe the amount. Like, my God, how the money is rolling in. United Defense is a weapons manufacturer out of Virginia that is owned by the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group employs George Herbert Walker Bush as a senior advisor. He sits on the board of directors. These people are making millions and millions and millions of dollars off of this heightened war level. You have Dick Cheney's Halliburton making hundreds of millions of dollars, not only off processing the oil, but building the permanent military bases over there, which they're doing through their subsidiary, Brown & Root. Now, Halliburton is still paying Dick Cheney a $1 million a year paycheck. They're calling it a deferred retirement benefit. I mean, here in Boston, we call that a paycheck. It's one of the many areas where it makes me want to tear my teeth out to consider the level of journalistic integrity that we're dealing with in the mainstream at this point, where we have a sitting vice president who is arguably in control of things, drawing a $1 million paycheck from the very company that is dealing with the oil over in Iraq and was allowed to get in there in the first place without any sort of a bidding process that is normal to this kind of a function. They just got the job.
I want to get back to the evidence, or lack thereof, that they based this whole war with Iraq on. Way back when they were presenting this, there was, amongst some of the alternative media, they were presenting counterclaims to the evidence and basically saying that the evidence really was flimsy at best. The major media was totally silent on that, and now they're starting to speak up a little bit about it. But how do you see this as part of the problem?
There's so many different levels to this that it is appalling and amazing to consider. You look at the New York Times. This is the paper of record for the Western world, where the New York Times goes, much of the mainstream media is going to follow. And the New York Times, in the guise of their reporter Judy Miller, were the central promulgators of the myth that Iraq was armed to the teeth, had all these Al-Qaeda connections, and were going to give these weapons to the terrorists when the time came. This reporting went from the New York Times to the rest of the mainstream and created the popular fiction that we've been enduring. The problem is that Judy Miller, who was the main person on the beat for this, for the New York Times, was getting the vast majority of her information from a guy named Ahmad Chalabi. Now, Ahmad Chalabi is the head of the Iraqi National Congress. He's been working fist in glove with Don Rumsfeld and the rest of these hawks who have wanted this war for years. Chalabi is Rumsfeld's hand-picked choice to run Iraq in the aftermath of the war. He's about to take command of the leadership council that they've cobbled together there, which is basically a satellite to Paul Bremer. Ahmed Chalabi had every reason in the world to lie, and as it has been exposed, Ahmed Chalabi sold Judy Miller and the New York Times a budget of profound misinformation. So when this happens, when the New York Times reports this stuff, when a story like this gets the imprimatur of the New York Times, it winds its way into every other major news source in the world, or in America anyway, because those news sources feel like they're safe by having reported on something that the New York Times reported on. The problem that we're having now is that they've been proven to have been completely and totally duped, and, you know, these newspaper people don't like to eat crow and admit that they were wrong and admit that they've been duped, so a redress of this particular situation is a long time coming. It took the Washington Post's ombudsman to bop Judy Miller on the head about this.
Getting back to Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress, if one didn't know any better, the whole concept of the Iraqi National Congress by its label sounds fairly authentic, that it represents a lot of people in Iraq.
The Iraqi National Congress became a legitimized group, essentially. These guys started out by basically dealing with anybody on the planet. They were telling people that they'll give anybody all the oil they want so long as whoever comes along helps them to get back into power. The Iraqi National Congress became a legitimized group in 1998 when the same group of hardcore neoconservatives, including Don Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Louis Libby, John Bolton, Robert Zoellick, and the rest of them, signed a letter to President Clinton denouncing him for not rolling tanks into Baghdad to get rid of these guys. The sum of that became something called the Iraqi Liberation Act, which was passed by the Gingrich Congress in 1998, which basically gave millions of dollars of taxpayer money to the Iraqi National Congress to legitimize their efforts. So these guys have been around for a while. This didn't just come up.
Sticking with Chalabi and his group, some of the information that the current administration used to justify the war in Iraq came from a little-known organization within the Pentagon called the Office of Special Plans. Can you tell us about that?
The Office of Special Plans is a creation of Don Rumsfeld. It is essentially a outside organization that is beyond the CIA, beyond the State Department, under absolutely no congressional oversight, filled with absolute rank amateurs as far as the intelligence business goes, people who are ideologically conformed to what Don Rumsfeld wants to hear. And these guys wound up being the main source of the information. This is marvelous echo chamber, became the main source of information delivered to George Bush and the rest of those guys, which then delivered it to the American people. The problem is that their main source of information, again, was Ahmad Chalabi. The reason why they were able to supersede CIA and state and be the main source of information was because their main sponsor was Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney went down to CIA on three different occasions and browbeat the analysts over there for, quote, forward-leaning intelligence. When he couldn't go, his assistant Scooter Libby went. When Scooter Libby wasn't able to go, Newt Gingrich went down on three or four occasions to browbeat these guys. And when CIA and state finally told these guys that the information that OSP was putting out was questionable at best, basically, CIA and state got completely cut out of the loop, and the Office of Special Plans, Don Rumsfeld's crew, essentially cherry-picked information and manipulated it to suit what they already wanted to do. That was the information that was being delivered to the decision-makers in the White House, who already knew what they wanted to do anyway, so it was just everybody, it's groupthink, and it was groupthink that completely cut out the main sources of analysis for this particular information, which makes the fact that they're trying to scapegoat the CIA all the more laughable, because this is not the CIA's fault. The CIA was cut out of the loop and is now getting scapegoated for this stuff, and it's remarkable that this is taking place. Now, there is a woman who was a lieutenant colonel in the Defense Department whose name is Karen Kwiatkowski, who has just recently retired and has gone completely public about how badly manipulated the information was coming out of this crew. She sent an email to her superior a few days before she quit. When she got an email saying, this is our evidence, this is what we've got, it's going to be great, everyone say this and we're going to be fine, she wrote back and said, if this is the best stuff that we've got, then there are going to be some people in the E-ring of the Pentagon sitting on a war crimes tribunal right next to Saddam Hussein. And then 3 days later, she retired. So here's one insider from this exact particular crew looking at this and saying, this was disgusting. This was nauseating. I'll quote you. What I saw was aberrant, pervasive, and contrary to good order and discipline. If one is seeking the answers to why peculiar bits of intelligence found sanctity in a presidential speech, or why the post-Saddam occupation has been distinguished by confusion and false steps, one need look no further than the process inside the Office of Secretary of Defense. And goes on to talk about the Office of Special Plans, called it a subversion of constitutional limits on executive power and a co-option through deceit of a large segment of Congress. That office was charged with collecting, vetting, and disseminating information completely outside the normal intelligence apparatus. In fact, it appears that the information collected by this office was in some instances not even shared with the established intelligence agencies, and in numerous instances was passed on to the National Security Council and the President without having been vetted by anyone other than the Secretary of Defense. Quote, I personally witnessed several cases of staff officers being told not to contact their counterparts at State of the National Security Council because that particular decision would be processed through a different channel. So, that's the deal. That's why we went to war. That's why groups like the Washington Post and New York Times and the other mainstream media were allowed to promulgate such a massive amount of misinformation, because that misinformation was being fed to them by Donald Rumsfeld's crew, having already cut out the CIA, the State Department, and anybody else with a reasonable level of intelligence experience.
One of the people, or the primary person, to my understanding, heading up this Office of Special Plans is a guy named Douglas Feith.
Mm-hmm.
I saw in an article in a paper last week where his office was again tied to a meeting that just recently happened in Paris with former Iran-Contra figure Ghulbanifar. I'm not pronouncing the name correctly.
Now,
so
Ghulbanifar is one of the central guys from the old days back in Iran-Contra. I mean, this is where I came in, you know. And the idea here is to do some sort of back-channel messing around to get Iran belligerent, and when Iran gets belligerent, then we can say, look, we're being dared to go to war. We have to go do this. So this is kind of a first step towards instigating some sort of a crunch with Iran in the next days, weeks, or months.
It seems phenomenal to me how many people who are involved with Iran-Contra have been brought back into the current administration, one of them who just resigned, John Poindexter.
Well, this administration has for a while now been a rehabilitation project for former criminals. John Poindexter, John Negroponte, Elliot Abrams, I mean, geez, Henry Kissinger, for God's sake. All of these people were up to their necks in the Iran-Contra scandal. I mean, if these guys tried to become police in any local police department, they wouldn't be able to do it because of their record as having been convicted of lying to Congress, destroying evidence, this, that, and the other thing. Yet here they are in the highest policy positions within this particular government. It's appalling beyond words.
Let's move on and talk a bit about your book that you are on tour with. Tell me about the title you chose for this book, The Greatest Sedition is Silence, 4 Years in America. How did you come up with that?
Well, 4 Years in America is essentially, we're dealing with, the book covers a lot of things starting before the 2000 election and up to, you know, fairly present day. The book got published before we really started jamming into this war situation in Iraq, which is why the War on Iraq book came out. But The Greatest Sedition is Silence is a line that was used by Bill Moyers in a very brave speech that he gave on the 16th of October, 2001, just after the September 11th attacks, when everyone was still really freaked out, the media was completely playing ball with the administration, and nobody was saying anything, and Ari Fleischer was telling people to watch what they say, and here comes Bill Moyers in a speech that he gave to some agricultural gathering, that in this time and in this place, with all that is happening, the greatest sedition at this point would be our silence. And I just thought that it was a perfect title for what it is that I'm talking about and what it is that I'm trying to accomplish with my readership.
And it seems one of the primary tools for creating this silence amongst the populace is fear.
Fear is it. Fear is everything. Without the fear, they're defeated. It is central to this process to keep moving forward with the program that they have to make people as afraid as possible of the world around them. Anything that they can make you afraid of, they will try to make you afraid of to justify this program that they have. And if we're going to overcome any of this, the first thing that we have to overcome is the idea that people need to be afraid. When people are afraid, they allow themselves to be easily led.
What are some of the things that people can be doing to overcome their fear?
Becoming informed as to what's happening would be the first rule. Read truth out. Go seek out alternative forms of information that are reliable and viable, and become informed as to what's happening. When you see the game that's being played on you, you stop being afraid and you start getting angry. I think that is the first and most central step. Inform people who may not know. I had an interesting moment just yesterday. I walked down to the little tweeter store in my neighborhood here to buy a CD, Walkman. And I'm there shooting the breeze with the desk guy, and he mentioned San Francisco, and I said, I just got back from there, and I mentioned that I'm a journalist, and I've talked to a bunch of different guys who are running for president right now, and he rattled off the list that he was aware of and mentioned Joe Lieberman, and I said, well, Joe Lieberman is in trouble with the base at this point because he voted for the Iraq War and he voted for the Patriot Act. And the guy said, well, what's the Patriot Act? He'd never heard of it before. And this is a guy who spends his days at work surrounded by functioning televisions, but he's never heard of the Patriot Act. So I spent 10 minutes there breaking it down for him, and his jaw was on the floor by the time I was finished. So to say that a vast number of Americans are out there who know that this stuff is going on and are putting up with it is to, in large part, miss the point. Even in, I mean, I live in Harvard Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, one of the most progressive places that you'll ever find on the East Coast. And here is a guy working right in the middle of it who's never heard of the Patriot Act, doesn't know about Section 213 that lets them come into your house, search your stuff, bug your phone and your computer without having a warrant or without ever letting you know that you were there. I told him all this stuff, and he was completely blown away. A lot of people get frustrated because they think that the American people are just sort of sheep going along with this, letting it happen. They don't care. They don't know. They don't know to care. But the fact of the matter is that they are profoundly underinformed by this 24-hour mainstream media news situation that does not tell people about this stuff. So really, it comes down to us. You stop being afraid. Put bumper stickers on your car, wear a button on your shirt, put a sign in your yard, prove to other people that there is nothing to fear but fear itself, or more importantly, nothing to fear but the individuals that want to make you afraid for their own purposes. Once you've reached that point, you can start telling people about what's going on, your neighbor, your friends, your family, whoever, and begin to let people know where we stand at this point. If you do that, you will have done an enormous amount.
What do you recommend to people dealing with those first people that might be disagreeing with them on their bumper sticker or their button?
Well, you get somebody who disagrees with you and your bumper sticker, odds are you're driving down the road and aren't going to have much time to have a substantive conversation. Meeting people on the street, meeting people in your bar, meeting people in your church, meeting people in your workplace, all you need to be able to deal with these people is information, hard information. Develop a little dossier. Develop 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 news links that you can send to people who can say, you don't believe me? Here, here's the deal. Read this. You tell me I'm wrong. You tell me that this is incorrect.
Does media reform fit into this formula?
Of course it does, but media reform is not going to happen until after the 2004 election, if we can take back at least the House, if not the House and the White House, because media reform at this point is going to come from the top down. All of this deregulation has come from the top down. It needs to be re-regulated. In order for it to be re-regulated, we need to have somebody in the White House or people in the House of Representatives who can push a re-regulation process and create an FCC office that is more than just a rubber stamp for the deregulators. So if you need one reason to get yourself involved with a candidate, either a House candidate or a presidential candidate for the 2004 race, media reform could very easily be a hood ornament on why it is that you would do that.
Yourself, do you feel pretty confident that things could change here with this coming election?
I do. I'll tell you something. A lot of people talk about George is going to have, you know, almost $250 million at his disposal to run in this 2004 presidential election, which he's running unopposed at this point in the primaries. A lot of people look at that and say, oh, it's no use. He's going to, you know, he'll have all the money in the world. I kind of turn it on my head and say, he's raising all of this money because he knows that he's going to need it. You know, he's going to need every dime of that to overcome the disaster that has been the last 4 years. And I also think about the 2000 presidential election. You had Al Gore running. You know, he had his problems as a candidate, but he had the great economy and he had all this other stuff going for him. And there were 6 or 7 or 8 fairly goofy presidential candidates on the Republican side, including George W. Bush. And a lot of people thought that it was going to be a waste of time. And one of those people managed to rise up through the ranks and actually get a hold of the office. Granted, he lost the election and won the lawsuit, but it did happen. So to say that it's impossible and it's not worth the time and it's completely useless is to really miss the point. I think that 2004 is very, very, very much in play. And the only way that it is going to happen is if good-hearted, like-minded people get together and decide, in the words of one president, that this will not stand.
Speaking of people getting together, I know you're going to be out here in Seattle on the 21st of August with your new book, The Greatest Sedition is Silence, as well as you have another new book. Tell us about the second book.
The second book is a collection of essays that I've written over the course of the last year and a half. It's called Our Flag 2, The Paradox of Patriotism. And what it is more than anything else is a declaration of principles in terms of we certainly cannot allow these sort of false patriots, if you will, to steal that flag and to steal the concept of patriotism from us. We stand against the war. We stand against the Patriot Act. We stand against this administration, and that is our flag, too. So there's an essay about that. There are several essays about the Iraq War. There are several essays about the still lingering mysteries surrounding September 11th. And the overall general issue is that people need to, you know, get their feet moving and take back the concept of patriotism that has been so wrongfully stolen from us.
So people will be able to come and hear you speak at Town Hall in Seattle on the Thursday the 21st at 7:30 p.m., as well as, I understand, you've, as you said when you started out, you've been pegged to speak at least one of the Bush rallies, welcoming committees here in Seattle.
Yeah, George is dumb enough to come to Washington thinking that he's going to get a big hug. And a whole, I guess the emails have been flying all over the Pacific Northwest to get together a little welcoming committee for him when he gets there. And I am privileged to have been invited to speak at one of these. I don't know which one. I don't know if they're all going to come together under one umbrella demonstration or what, but you will find me at the podium for one of those.
Anything else you want to add in?
Look up the Veterans for Peace, especially if you are a veteran yourself. Their website is veteransforpeace.org. And I'll tell you a little, the last night that I was there, I had the fortune of sitting down with the current director for dinner. His name is Woody Powell. And Mr. Powell, we were talking about the organization and just talking about, I was going on and on about how much of a wonderful time I'd had while I was there. And he noted that every time they have one of these conventions, they get hundreds and hundreds of people who just show up out of the woods to come and see what the group is about. And he had many, many, many occasions over this past weekend, he found people who had just shown up sitting there, you know, veterans, sitting there and weeping. And when he would go to talk to them, they would say to a man that they felt like they were home now, that here were some guys who finally understood where they were coming from, and it was just a sort of an overwhelming sense of having come home. This is a remarkable group, and if you are a veteran out there who is worried about the manner in which all of this is unfolding, veteransforpeace.org, all one word, should be something right at the top of your priorities that you should check out and look into and see where they're coming from. And even if you're not a vet but want to know for a fact that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of American veterans who stand vociferously against the manner in which all of this is unfolding, that is an organization that you should look into immediately.